Hi, I'm Jamie from Stonemaier Games, and today I'm going to talk about thematically designed mechanisms in Stonemaier Game. I limited this to Stonemaier Games for a few reasons. One, because I would say almost every game that I play, except for strictly abstract games, have some mechanism that is thematically inspired or thematically designed. And so I needed a way to narrow it down. And also, someone specifically asked for me to talk about Stonemaier Games in this context. So that's why I'm doing so. I love this topic. I love mechanisms that are designed based on a specific theme because it for a number of reasons. One, it makes them easier to explain, makes them easier to retain, makes them easier to learn and understand. I think it helps with the ease of play in a number of different ways. And I think it helps with immersion. If the mechanisms, if the things that you're doing in the game feel like what they would feel like in real life or whatever the world is that you're playing in, I think that adds to the immersion, adds to the experience of playing the game. So that is the topic I'm going to cover today for Stonemaier Games. And I asked Stonemaier ambassadors to help out with this, and they offered some great suggestions. And so a lot of this video will be me sharing what ambassadors have said about various games. I'll do them in alphabetical order, and I'll show them on the other screen. I'll show an image from the other screen, here we go, of each of the games as I talk about them. Yeah, let's jump right in. So Apiary is the first one in alphabetical order. So in Apiary, a few people said a few different things here. One, they mentioned the hibernation tokens. This person says it's cool that level 4 bees go into hibernation, and when there's a full hibernation section, the game ends. This is a interesting thematic element to mention in particular, because the hibernation in Apiary, when your bee it would age past level 4, you can see over here, you can see a level 3 bee. When it ages past level 4, it goes into hibernation. In real life, real honeybees would actually die at that point, but that's the theme of this game. This game is a sci-fi version where bees have evolved beyond that and they go into hibernation instead of dying. So this is not just tying to a real life bee theme, but also to partially the sci-fi theme. Another person mentioned one of my favorite thematic mechanisms in Apiary, which is pollinating planets with the queenship. And that's kind of what we're actually seeing on the screen here. This is, here's the queenship over here. When you explore an apiary, you move the queenship to a planet, and you can see all these tokens on planets, because whenever you explore a planet that has an open slot like this one does, bees actually make the planet better. They pollinate it with one of the basic resources, either pollen, fiber, or water. They make that planet better, and then they reap some resources from that planet, but they're leaving the planet better than when they arrived. I love that theme in Apiary. Another person says that aging bees get more powerful. And I like that too. I love the worker placement mechanism in Apiary, where the more that you use each worker miniature, it gets stronger and it makes the actions that it takes stronger. Let's see. This person says the setting for Apiary. They like the setting in general. Humans leaving, bees taking over and evolving to become the dominant species. That's not specifically tied to a mechanism, but I like that general idea. And the use of the honey resource to carve special tiles in Apiary. Yeah, so there are three basic resources in Apiary, and there are two special ones, wax and honey. They're a little bit more difficult to get. And honey in particular is used for carving tiles, which is, I think, a little similar to the way that honey is used by real honeybees to build their hives. A few more thoughts on Apiaries. Let's see, worker bees that hibernate when they grow old and tired. And bee strength culminating in level 4 bonuses. So not only are bees getting stronger, but when you place a level 4 bee or strength 4 bee, you can see each action has a super powerful benefit that you gain from placing a strength 4 bee there. It feels really good when you get there. All right, so a lot of thoughts on Apiary. I will have, there are more ambassador responses from some games than others. Apiary is one that received a lot of responses. You'll see a few more of those. Between Two Castles is the next game. And Between Two Castles just has one response here. So it's a fairly abstract game, despite the beautiful art that showcases different rooms. It's a somewhat abstract game, but it does have one tile type, and I actually don't have it in the image here, The tile type are the outdoor rooms. Let's see if I can find one. Yeah, here's some. They're a little hard to see, but there's some outdoor rooms over here. They have a blue border around them to signify that they're outdoors, and you can't place anything above them. Unlike normal rooms, so most of the rooms in Between Two Castles, you are looking at the castle from a first-person perspective, kind of a side view, and so there are different floors. So like this is the ground floor, this is the second floor. So it makes sense that because this room, this throne room, has a ceiling, that there could be a building above it. But for the outdoor rooms, there's no ceiling above them. There's open air. And so this is one way, a few examples I'll give today. This is one example of theme explaining an exception in the rules. I generally do not like putting exceptions in rules because it's one more thing to remember. But when theme helps with that, I think that is maybe the rare case that an exception is okay. If the theme explains the exception and it makes sense Between Two Castles that you can't put a room above an outdoor room because it's just air above you, not a ceiling. So I like that thematically designed mechanism in Between Two Castles. The next game is Between Two Cities. These are some of the tiles in the Essential Edition for Between Two Cities. And I think my favorite thematically designed mechanism here, this is something mentioned by an ambassador too, is that houses don't want to be next to factories. And let's see, there weren't a lot of photos available of this game. Yeah, here's one. So here is a residential tile, one of the houses. And houses in general just want a lot of different buildings in the neighborhood. In the city, they want a lot of different types of buildings there. They want variety. However, houses do not want to be next to factories or industrial areas. And that's noted right here, really small, that houses don't want to be next to factories. So no matter how many different buildings you have in your city, if you place your house next to a factory, the house is only worth 1 point. I think that's, it's not an exception to the rule here. It's explained in the icons, but I like that it is, that it's thematically designed around this idea that you probably wouldn't want your house next to a factory or an industrial area if you can avoid it. That is Between Two Cities. Let's look at Charterstone. Again, it's full of spoilers, so I have a non-spoiler photo here. This is what you look at when you open the box of Charterstone. And so I don't want to spoil any of the thematic things that you unlock as you go. One of my favorite thematic mechanisms in Charterstone is the idea that you're opening crates. So whenever you build a building, you can use the building card, the remnant of it. You can see some right over here. Let's see if zooming helps. No, I always forget how to move around when I zoom. But you can see here that this player has peeled a building sticker off this card. And in the upper right-hand corner, really small, you can't see it, but there's a little crate number. And that's saying that if you go to the Charterstone building and you can unlock that crate and you can open up new stuff. And it really is like you're opening a crate and getting new stuff. And you get to go into the scriptorium and gain some new cards in Charterstone. I like that thematic mechanism. But I think my favorite thematic mechanism in Charterstone, non-spoiler mechanism at least, is something that I borrowed directly from another game, a Ryan Lockett Red Raven game. I'm forgetting the game right now. Oh, it's a game about going between different aisles. It's not Sleeping Gods. It's an earlier game. But the mechanism here, in that game, it's boasting. In this game, it's grandstanding. So if you achieve an objective in Charterstone and you want credit for it, you have to go to a building that's literally called the grandstand, and you have to blast it out. You have to use your influence at the grandstand to just share it with people and let them know this amazing objective that you've completed. I love that idea thematically. I like the idea of completing objectives in general, but sometimes in games when you complete objectives, it's you don't really get all that much credit for it. But when you have a grandstand or a boast action in a game, it feels good. You're boasting about your grandstand. So I like that thematic mechanism in Charterstone. Next up, we have Euphoria. There were a lot of great things from ambassadors about Euphoria. This person says the happiness track or the morale track determines hand size and intelligence, which is knowledge. Causes you to lose a worker die. In this dystopia, you want your workers dumb and content. And this is something echoed by a number of different ambassadors. The idea that on your workers are dice, and the number on them is knowledge. And because the theme of this game is a dystopia, it's a dystopian theme, having workers that are too smart isn't actually a good thing. You don't want them to be so smart that they figure out that they're doing your bidding in a dystopia. So when you place a worker, it's fine for a worker to have high knowledge. It isn't necessarily better for the action, but it's generally fine. But it's when you retrieve workers or when workers are bumped off the board and you have to roll them and you add up the total sum of the worker knowledge along with your knowledge track number. If that number is too high, then one of your workers realizes, wait a minute, I'm in a dystopia, and they run away. It's a mechanism that I designed from the ground up as a thematic mechanism of knowledge. Workers getting together and talking about it and be like, wait a minute, we are in a dystopia here, and one of them runs away. It's a tough moment in the game when that happens, when a worker runs away. I may have made it a little bit too harsh even, but it is a thematic one. Let's say someone else says they like the knowledge die numbers in Euphoria. So this person mentions the idea of gaining workers. So it's still tied to workers. This choice that you have, and I'm not showing this portion of the board right now, but you can get more workers in Euphoria. You start out with two workers and you can get up to two more. There's a risk when you do that, those workers, especially when you retrieve all of them, might run away. You don't have to retrieve all of them. That's one way to work around it. But the way you get workers is that you either, essentially shock them into existence. That's one of the ways to do that. So that's also another little thematically designed action there. Let's see if there's any other mentions, comments here from ambassadors that go beyond the worker knowledge. Yeah, people seem to really love the idea of workers that are happy and dumb in this dystopia. That's Euphoria. In Expeditions, Expeditions had a bunch of answers too. So this person says, I like that the mechs and in Expeditions and Psy, the game that I'll talk about later, usually fit the nature of their ability. So for example, Marsh Strider, the one with the long legs down here, they have very long legs. They can move farther than other mechs. Odin's Wrath, which is the one that looks a little bit like a Viking ship, it has an exploring bonus. I appreciate this person noticing that because I definitely tried to design each of these mechs to have a special ability that's tied to the way they look, the way they're designed, the way Jakob created these mechs. Let's see. This person likes the different types of workers in Expeditions. This is kind of a subtle thing in Expeditions, different workers focusing on different things. You use workers in Expeditions to place on cards. So you play a card, and at the moment that you play a card, you can gain a benefit, an extra benefit, based on what's on that card, if you place a specific color worker on that card. And I designed different cards around different benefits. Or different abilities around different colors of workers. So this person says, especially for the twisted purple workers, I think they're called weird or possessed in the game. So I'm glad this person noticed that different workers do focus on different things in the game. This person says they like the search for and the melding of meteorites. The idea that you're finding this meteor has crashed and you are going to find it. You're searching for it and you're finding little bits and pieces of it and you don't know what they're doing, what they do really. And you just, if you do attach them to your ship, you get an ongoing, not an ongoing benefit, but you get an enhanced benefit whenever you do that. Melding makes gives you more and more coins the more and more you meld. This person likes the random tile setup for Expeditions. They say the feeling of discovery is cool. You have an idea of what's out there, and after a couple of plays, you even know the tiles, but you don't know exactly where you are whenever you play. They say it feels like you're following rumors or leads, because you do have an idea what's out there, but you don't know when or where you'll find it. This person says, a meteorite landed in the north. Let's all hop in our mechs and go loot it. Almost all the mechanisms support that narrative, like melding a meteorite to your mech. Definitely true. Yeah, so that's some thoughts on thematically designed mechanisms in Expeditions. In Libertalia, Winds of Galecrest, this person says thieving pirates in Libertalia, and they like the way, someone else says, I like the way that Libertalia character actions match the character. And that is definitely something that Paolo tried to do and that I try to help out with a little bit as a developer here with each card designed around that character's name or title. And sometimes we had to, we actually changed the name of the character to fit an ability. So it might have gone either way. For example, the explorer here says if you gain a map token, of course it's a map because they're an explorer, gain 2 reputation. And their anchor, their end of round ability, is one of your map tokens counts as 2 map tokens. The treasurer says gain 1 coin for each barrel, each amulet, and each other chest token in your ship. The treasurer, of course, they're dealing with money and resources and treasure, things like that. Treasurer deals with treasure. And the preacher here, keep 1 of your loot tokens and discard the others. Gain 1 reputation for each discarded loot token. Actually, I don't know how that's all that tied to the theme of the preacher. But the explorer and the treasurer were good examples there. My Little Scythe is next up. That was Libertalia I was just talking about. Here is My Little Scythe. And this person says, I really like the pie fights in My Little Scythe and the way they affect your friendship. Also, just making and getting pies for friendship requests. So yeah, we use friendship, which is kind of the popularity track in Scythe. In My Little Scythe, it is friendship. When you attack someone in My Little Scythe, you lose 1 friendship. You lose 1 heart. It's not health. It's friendship, because no one likes a friend who is attacking you. You can get more friendship by going on quests. So if you help other players on quests, it's just, you know, something on the quest card saying something that you can do, you can gain even more friendship there. So the idea of friendship is really interwoven well, I think, into the mechanisms of My Little Scythe. We have a few responses for our game Pendulum with these timers. And Pendulum, real time as a resource. So time as unobstructed as possible in Pendulum. When you're using time, you're actually using these time sand timers. You're not really using them, actually. You have workers that are locked into actions for a certain amount of time based on how long that action takes. And there are 3 different sand timers of different lengths for different types of actions in the game. Someone else also says, I really like the hourglass mechanism. And this person says, when I explain the hourglass to new people, I liken them to doing a real-world job. When the hourglasses are at a location, the worker is on the clock and can take advantage of the location. When the hourglass is not on the location, the worker can drive to and from work. This is the person explaining this mechanism. I think that explains it well, that there are certain times where you can move workers off these actions and certain times where they're locked in. They're actually doing the work while the timer is ticking down. That's a Pendulum. We have a few responses for Red Rising. This person says, the relationships between the card identities, the themes, and the mechanisms are so alive and rich. And one of the things that we tried to do in Red Rising is not spoil anything about the plot of the books, but to talk pretty freely about the way the characters work. Again, we don't have flavor text on the cards that gives anything away from the books, but we really did design every single card in the game around the theme of that character, or especially if it's a specific character. For example, Uncle Nero, he works in the mines in Mars, so he gains helium. He's mining for helium. He also says 40 points if with only cards having core values of 10 points or less. He's one of the people. He's a man of the people, so he wants people who are valued less by society, unfortunately. Io here, each opponent must reveal a red. If they can't, they lose 1 helium. She wants other players to have reds, or she doesn't trust them, basically. 10 points for each other red, and minus 10 if with a gray, except for bridge. So this is kind of like a little hint at the plot of the story, that Io doesn't like the police, basically. But there's a specific character called Bridge that Io is okay with. And so it isn't really spoiling anything about the books, but it is hinting that there's a deeper lore happening here. And then Darrow, the main character, gain any other non-gold from this location. Darrow's really good at recruiting people, bringing people in. Banish Darrow unless you deployed him on a gold. So there's a contingency there about Darrow. 30 points if you have 7 or more cards, including Darrow. So Darrow wants a lot of people to join his effort. Darrow is someone who often tries to do things alone, but he also is at the same time realizing the value of having other people around. Some other responses from people here that go into what I was saying here, the thoughtfulness behind character pairs or avoiding pairs. Some characters want to be with someone else or don't want to be with someone else specific. And Red Rising's character system, and as someone who's read the books, always finds it fun sculpting your hand. So I appreciate that, that like if you've read the books, you can recognize these things. If you haven't read the books, hopefully it makes you curious about these characters without actually spoiling anything. That is Red Rising. We're on to Rolling Realms, which is a fairly abstract game, but this is a game that's designed around specific elements from other games. Every realm in Rolling Realms is a mini game designed around another game, a mechanism generally in another game, but oftentimes we're trying to build that theme into it as well as best as we can. And two people comment on this. One person says, I truly love how each realm feels like a distilled version of their base games. They all do a good job of feeling like roll and write versions of the game they're based off of, and it's an impressive feat. Another person says, the scoring mechanism from all different Rolling Realms promos and base game cards, good variability and complexity. I appreciate that as well. But yeah, you can see, you know, again, this is a fairly abstract game, but it's a game that ideally makes you recognize the theme in the game of origin. So viticulture, you're trying to create grapes and then use those grapes to turn them into wine. A pendulum, you have these timers that you are filling up and then kind of flipping over at different times to gain stars. It's a little bit of a stretch, but it's also just an interesting experiment to design mini games based on other games and for them to make sense somehow based on a person who may or may not understand how the original game works. And hopefully sometimes someone plays a realm in Rolling Realms and likes it enough that they might go discover a new game based on that realm if we've done our job well. All right, lots of different comments on Scythe. People love the thematically designed mechanisms in Scythe, or at least our ambassadors do. So here's an image that I'll use. This does not describe nearly all the things that I'll talk about here. A few people mentioned encounter cards. So this person describes it well, in my opinion. The reward descriptions add a role-playing feel to the game, giving you your decision a certain morality beyond simply selecting from resource options. With these brief, flavorful descriptions and the faction leader backgrounds, you could incorporate storytelling into the game if you wanted a more immersive experience. And that's exactly what I was aiming for with the encounter cards inside. They give you a few different options. There's always an option that you can get if you don't pay anything, and you can either then pay money or resources, or you can pay popularity. You can do something very unpopular, but have a strong benefit on these encounter cards. So yeah, a few people echoed that idea about encounter cards. Someone mentioned the idea of how only attackers lose popularity for displacing workers. A lot of people like this idea of popularity in Scythe, similar to the friendship in My Little Scythe, where if you are the aggressor in Scythe, if you're the attacker or someone who moves onto a territory with workers, which isn't combat, but you are forcing those workers off your land, you lose popularity. You lose one popularity per worker that you forced off the land. Someone else also mentioned the use of wooden workers. You can see a wooden worker here versus plastic figures. Mechs and characters are plastic inside to differentiate between units that can participate in combat and units that don't participate in combat. The workers are not fighting for you. That was intentional too, to have a difference between the composition of these actual tokens. So more of a product decision there than a mechanical decision. Speaking of encounters, this person says, I love that Anna and Wojtek are extra popular in encounters because of the bear's swagger. And that's one of several examples of ways that I tried to design the factions in Scythe around the different characters, the animal companion, and the mechs themselves. A few people also commented on worker cost in Scythe on their player mat. I don't have an image here. Let's see if I can find one quickly. On the player mat, here's a nice photo of the board, but not the player mats. The player mats have increasing costs based on how many workers you have on the board. And this person explains it well. I like in Scythe where if you have more workers, it costs more to use the produce action. It makes sense as it inherently costs more to get more people to work, which I think is a great thematic explanation for that mechanism. A few people also mentioned the upgrade mechanism in Scythe, which is when you pick up a cube from your player mat to make a benefit better, and you place that cube anywhere on the bottom section of your player mat to make a cost, to decrease a cost. It's one of these mechanisms where it is kind of abstract. You're picking up a cube and moving it somewhere, but once you do it once, you're like, oh, wow, I just made two actions better. That really did feel like I upgraded something in this game, which is exactly what I was going for. This person says, I really like the combat mechanism inside for its thematic design. The moment of tension, spending the resource for offense when you need it for defense. And that is somewhat shown in this photo here, where you're choosing an amount of power to spend on your combat dial, but you're also hiding a combat card here that the opponent can't see. So you're being a little bit, there's this feeling of sneakiness. You're actually hiding a card behind your dial. And so this idea where they don't exactly know what you're getting is, I think, a little thematic element here. A few people also mentioned that inside you leave all the resources on the board. You can see that here's a grain on the board. I think that's the only resource in the photo. But and mechs can actually carry those resources around. This is something that I really wanted to design inside. I wanted this idea that all the resources are on the board itself. They're not kept off to the side. They're on the board. Adding to the idea that there is a sense of place to this board. When you gain a resource, it doesn't just magically go to off the board of your home base. It's vulnerable. It's on the board until you actually spend it. That was something that a mechanism that I designed inside. Let's see if there's anything else here. The factory. Someone mentioned the factory in the middle of the board inside. I don't know if we can quite see it here, but there is a factory in the middle of the board. Oh, right here. There it is. And it's a little bit mysterious. You don't know what you're going to find there. You're going to find a factory card once you get there, but you don't know what the benefit of that card will be. And you can either kind of race to the factory and have the most choice of the cards that are available in that given game, or you can go there slowly and you'll still have a card or two to choose from when you get there, but you won't have as many choices when that happens. All right, lots of examples from Scythe here. Oh, someone also mentions for Scythe, Expeditions, and Tapestry, the maps, the board itself give a sense of adventure from having this map that you're looking out on, this world. All right, so that is a lot of stuff about Scythe. Let's move on to Smitten, which is, again, one of our more abstract games. You can also see it behind me here. But in Smitten, I did actually try to design the cards in this game, which is a light co-op game of completing grids. Again, very abstract, but I really did try to design the actions on the card. Oh, I have the Russian, maybe Ukrainian version. I don't think there is a Russian version of Smitten. Here's the English version. The English version of Smitten has each of the abilities is designed loosely around what the card is showing. So whether it's a game or you know, just people doing things, they're all designed around specific games, or the illustrations are designed around games. And so in Smitten, here's an example here. Your partner must place a card in this grid. Again, very loose designs here, but I really did, while looking at this art, I was like, what makes sense for this specific art? It looks like someone is you know, pulling their partner someplace else. So your partner must place a card in this grid. You're pulling them towards you so they can do something in this grid. This has a bird flying above everything. Your partner must reveal the top card of the deck and then place it on either grid. It's like the bird is scouting out a card, essentially. So not all of these are great examples for this, but I tried my best to design abilities, actions on these cards, which are mandatory, based around either what you're looking at on the card or loosely the game that card is inspired by in Smitten. We have a few different responses for Tapestry. This person says they like how the tracks in Tapestry. At the end of Exploration, I can travel to space, and the other tracks are thematically strong as well. They also like the little income buildings with their own thematic advancements. And so, yeah, I really tried to design these tracks. Here's a very close-up of someone's hand. I designed these tracks around the idea that, around specific ideas. You know, there's a science track, a technology track, and even though the benefits are a little bit abstract, I really did try to design each of the benefits for each section of the track based on the theme of that track. So, for example, when you go to space, there are actual space tiles that you get to gain and look at. With the military track, there are military type things that you're doing. You're conquering, and as your military gets stronger and more advanced, you're conquering in more varied ways. Like with warplanes, you can fly across the map. You don't have to be adjacent to something else. Exploring, you're putting a tile on the map. And with technology, you are getting these tech cards that give you abilities as they advance. This person says a science feels like a supplemental track that allows you to accelerate any of the others, which feels very thematic to them. So the idea that science is accelerating the other tracks felt thematic. This person says they like the theme of the different tech cards in Tapestry. The city building and city maps of Tapestry. I thought it was an unnecessary add-on when we first played, but it's a great puzzle that is a cool representation of your capital. And this is something that was really important to me in Tapestry, that I wanted you to have the sense that you built something extravagant. And so that's why there are these painted minis in Tapestry that are filling up your capital city. Let's see if we can find a photo of what that looks like. Here's a nice photo here of your capital city filling up. It is a little abstract. You're placing buildings onto a grid, but the more and more you put there, the more and more I think it feels like a city, and that it feels like you've actually built something. And that's important to me when I design. This person says the play of Tapestry cards in Tapestry as the eras pass sets a nice amount of theme and generates good, often humorous table talk. So yeah, so here's a little off screen here, but here's a Tapestry card played in the last era. Or the second to last era. All the Tapestry cards are designed around a specific theme in Tapestry. A few more games here. That was Tapestry. Let's look at viticulture. A lot of thoughts on viticulture. A lot of people mentioned the idea of aging grapes. So this is the passive benefit, or one of the two passive benefits in viticulture, that as each year turns, the grapes on your player mat gain in value. And this is actually a mechanism that that isn't all that thematic in viticulture. The grapes don't actually, in most types of most uses of grapes on vineyards and wineries, grapes don't gain value the longer they sit on your crush pad. You would generally use them right away. But I found that in playtesting, it was frustrating for players not to age grapes. And so you age grapes, and you also get to age your wine. So wine gains in value the longer that you have it, as wine does, or most wine does, not all wine, but most wine. So a bunch of people mentioned this idea of aging grapes and aging wine. Someone mentioned the grande worker in viticulture. I love knowing that you can always accomplish my most important action. So the grande worker is a worker that isn't limited by action spaces. You can place it on an action even if that action is full. And my thinking here for the design, other than it being a kind of a good answer to a problem in viticulture, is that the grinding worker is a big worker. It kind of makes sense that this worker could shove his or her way into an action and that no one can stop them, because it is a physically bigger meeple than the other meeples. So this person speaks to a few people spoke actually to the order of operations in viticulture, the idea that you are using certain types of buildings, irrigation and trellises, to plant vine cards. You're planting them on your fields, and then you are harvesting grape tokens from those fields, which is actually also tied to one of the most common mistakes in viticulture, which is that some people think that you're actually tearing out those vines whenever you harvest, which is not explained thematically. It doesn't make sense that if you go to pluck some grapes off a vine, that you'd also tear the vine off the field. And yet some people do make that mistake. You're just plucking tokens off plucking little grapes off the fields and putting them on your crush pad, and then turning those into wine and then selling that wine via wine orders and gaining a claim for that. This person talks about that process, this order of operations process. A couple other people are talking about it here. And let's see, a few other thoughts. Different ways you can gain points, like the tasting room gives you victory points for giving tours, and the summer and winter visitors add interesting touches that make me feel like I'm actually a vintner. I tried to design each of the visitor cards in viticulture around a little bit of a theme. It's a fairly light theme with those visitor cards, but I tried my best with them. And actually, someone also mentioned the choice at the beginning of a round in viticulture, the wake up track over here. Not sure actually why the person has grape tokens over there, but maybe that's a house rule that this person uses. Oh no, it's an automa thing. That's what it is, a solo mode thing. But yeah, the idea of waking up in viticulture, that your workers, that you'll go first in each season. And a few people did mention the different actions per season too, but the wake up track, that you're going first in each season, and by going first, you get a smaller or lesser benefit on the wake up track. But if you go later, you get a stronger benefit. That's it for Viticulture. We have two games left. A lot of stuff for Wingspan here and a few thoughts on Wormspan to end it. So Wingspan first. So in Wingspan, that the egg counts, the number of eggs a bird can hold, are related to real world birds, as well as the nest types. And this is really what drew me to Wingspan, even when it was in its infancy, a very different game than what Wingspan ended up being, was that Elizabeth does an amazing job, in my opinion, in tying the theme of each bird with its mechanisms, from the type of nest the bird has to the number of eggs it can hold. The point value is somewhat arbitrary. I mean, you could some might say that, you know, we will get into debate about the point values for birds, their abilities, and the types of food that you need to attract that bird to your sanctuary, and also the habitat. So every element of the bird is tied to its theme. This bald eagle, for example, says gain all fish that are in the bird feeder. Bald eagles are very good at catching fish, including pretty big fish. This person says, I like a lot of the thematic reasonings for things in Wingspan. For example, the birds that lay eggs on other birds, just like they use nests other birds have built in real life. Yeah, I love that. I mean, there are so many little things like that in Wingspan, where you can learn about how different birds operate based on the mechanisms that Elizabeth put into the game. Some of which are explained in the fun facts, and some of which you're kind of just learning from the mechanism. This one says, I love the connection between bird powers and bird behavior in Wingspan. For example, birds that are parasitic in their egg laying, similar to the ones that I mentioned a second ago, like cowbirds and cuckoos. Let's see. These birds don't do the work for caring for eggs in real life, and you don't even have to use an action to gain their benefit in the game. My favorite mechanism lately is the bumping mechanism. Oh, sorry, this person has a thought about apiary as well. They like the bumping mechanism in apiary, which isn't something I mentioned earlier in apiary, but this idea of bumping, where one bee is flying away and flits away to another, back to the player, so they can use it again. Back to Wingspan, though. I really like some of the powers of the Australian birds in Oceania, the Oceania expansion. I like the magpie's action, which mimics its tendency to swoop. So there's swooping birds. There are birds that migrate from different actions in Wingspan. There are birds that that tuck a lot of cards. I think someone has some comments about tucking. Here's one. My favorite piece of Wingspan is the northern mockingjay, which mocks or imitates another bird in the habitat. Here's the one about tucking, that tucking birds either represent that they're hunting things or maybe that they're flocking together, depending on the bird. And this person also says that smaller birds are sometimes eaten by bigger birds, which does echo something that happens in reality. Lots of theme in the bird designs of Wingspan. And finally, a small comment about Wormspan from someone who has either played it or has paid careful attention to it. This person says the Wormspan chaining of dragon powers by using a meeple that visits the cave, activates the dragons, and feeds the hatchlings makes a lot of sense. In Wormspan, you are moving an adventurer meeple down a cave, as long as you have dragon cards in that cave to let them keep advancing. We wanted that process in Wormspan of walking through a cave to feel thematic. Also, in my photo here, I brought up the hatchling cards. There are a few of the hatchling cards. There are 35 different hatchling cards. These are the ones, these hatchlings are cards that hatch from eggs. So you have to pay an egg to actually play the card. They all have a milk cost as well. And why milk? In fact, I'll read from the FAQ, because a lot of people ask, like, why milk? Why are these dragons? Because reptiles in the real world don't eat milk, but not all the dragons are actually reptiles. So I'll read that from the FAQ in a second. But so you're kind of drawing, you're creating this hatchling from milk. And then from then on, whenever you visit the hatchling, if you cache a resource, a specific resource that hatchling wants on the card, they give you a little benefit, whether they're like the cricket catchers are often like catching a cricket for you and giving you a meat when you catch them. Not this specific one, but some of them are catching crickets and giving you meat. But they're kind of giving you a little reward in return. And then finally, when you have three of the desired resource on the hatchling, it grows up and gives you a powerful one-time benefit. That's the last row on hatchling cards. I really, really love the theme of these hatchling cards and how they're designed. let's read about milk for a second in Wormspan. Let's see. Okay, so the question in the FAQ is, do dragons really drink milk? Here's what designer Connie Vogelman says about this. My thought was that if dragons are warm-blooded, a lot of lore depicts them that way, then perhaps many of the other evolutionary constraints on mammals also apply to dragons, which could include some kind of extra sustenance when young. And again, I'll take a break from Connie's quote for a second here. This is a fictional world of dragons. Like this is a whole world of dragons where dragons are a little bit like the birds of our world, where they're everywhere. They're all around us all the time, like birds are. Back to Connie. Connie says, plus nature is weird. Echidnas and platypuses are mammals that lay eggs, and many reptiles, including garter snakes, give birth to live young. It seems like milk was a good way to indicate, with a shorthand, that the resource is relevant only for the baby dragons, not for the adults. In my mind, dragons are a bit of all of them. They've evolved to fill a bunch of different ecological niches. So some are more like birds, and some are more like reptiles, and some are more like mammals. And you'll see this in the art for the dragons. There are some that look amphibian. There are some that look reptilian, some that look like mammals. There are all sorts of dragons exist in this world. Anyway, those are all of the games that we have published so far at Stillmire Games, and different thematic reasonings for the different mechanisms of the game, and mechanisms that were designed based on the theme. Many of them were designed from the theme itself, or a specific theme in that thematic element. And some of these things happened during playtesting, where we did something and we were like, oh wow, that feels thematic. That feels like I'm actually doing the thing that is abstracted in this game. And we hung on to that. We kept doing that in the game. We pursued that idea. So I love thematically designed mechanisms. I'd love to hear your examples for Stillmire Games or any other game that you've played. Especially if it's a very specific thing in the game where you're like, oh wow, that really felt like the thing that the game was trying to make me feel like I was doing. I'd love to hear your examples in the comments below. Thanks.